Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Finding Pennsylvania's solar future is a report from the state that sets a goal of solar power providing 10% of Pennsylvania's electricity by the year 2030. Currently, less than 1% of electricity is produced by solar. So how do we get to that goal? Joining us on today's program is Patrick McDonnell, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection. Secretary McDonnell, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is David Althoff, who is the Director of DEP's Energy Program. Mr. Althoff, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary McDonnell, 10% of the state's electricity coming from solar within 12 years. That seems ambitious. How will it be done?
Well, that's the reason we put together the Finding PA Solar Future Plan. The effort started over a year ago, pulling together over 500 stakeholders using some Department of Energy dollars that we received to do this evaluation. And what we found in the report is 15 different strategies of how we advance grid scale solar power, how we advance rooftop, distributed solar, and the mechanisms that we'll need to put in place in order to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania Solar Future Plan. What was its purpose, and how did it come about?
So the way it came about was in discussions with Department of Energy and some other solar stakeholders, wanting to really organize around what we need to do next on solar. The Advanced Energy Portfolio Standard in 2021 will reach kind of the peak of what we can expect out of that, which is 0.5% of solar, which when we did that in 2004 was forward-looking, but you fast forward to 2018, and what we see is states around us with solar goals over 1%, in some cases up to 8.5%.
That's Massachusetts.
Yes. Yeah. So we wanted to see where we need to go with solar, especially given all of the things that have changed within the market around solar. The prices dropped dramatically. We're seeing the market take off both on the grid scale side and on the distributed side, and we want to make sure we're well positioned to take advantage of that both environmentally and economically.
When you say the cost has gone down dramatically, what do you mean by that?
Well, you're talking about a resource where the installed cost is really, if you look back over the last 15, 20 years, the installed cost has dropped year over year 10-15% a year. So what was a resource where you were talking about well over $10 a kilowatt to put in, now it's very, very low. We were talking to some commercial developers who were putting in systems around 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is very, very competitive with your traditional electric generation.
Most people, though, probably don't look at it per kilowatt hour. They look at it, what's this going to cost me up front?
Sure. No, and one of the things we've seen is some innovative financial products, including in some cases lease arrangements where it really just becomes part of your energy bill. If you want, as a homeowner or as a resident, you can purchase a system and finance it that way. Frankly, that's the route I chose when we put solar on our house. So there's a variety of ways to go about doing this, and you do see, the rate that you're paying on your electric bill drop dramatically. So financing it and then being able to pay it back, it won't necessarily work out, dollar for dollar for everyone. You need to do that evaluation on your own. But, we're in a much, much different space than we were when I and Dave Althoff started doing this work 20 years ago.
Dr. Althoff, Pennsylvania's electricity is about 4% of it is produced by renewables right now. And there are several. I'm not going to list all of them. But more than half of that is wind. Why promote solar when it appears that wind has a renewable foothold?
And, well, that is correct. Wind does have a renewable foothold. And there was a build-out of wind that occurred several years ago. I mean, we had a goal sort of with regards to wind to do a gigawatt of wind, 1,000 megawatts of wind. And we've actually exceeded that goal in Pennsylvania. Wind is a resource. There are certain places where it is windy in order to put utility-scale wind. And we've basically populated a lot of those areas within the state.
Everyone thinks of Somerset County with when you're driving along a turnpike, you see those windmills, if that's what you want to call
them. And in reality, wind is a good case study for us relative to solar. You know, there was issues with regards to siting wind, view sheds, proper locations, transmission interconnection, all of those things. And so we're going to see the same build-out, I believe, in solar, only greater, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, technology has come along with regards to wind. There's opportunities to potentially site more wind in Pennsylvania. The wind resource hasn't changed, but the ability to capture that wind resource and turn it into energy has. So there's still places to go with regards to terrestrial wind, which is onshore, on the land wind. There's also discussions about offshore wind. That's a potential large resource as well. But Pennsylvania's opportunities are probably, big opportunities are in solar.
Mm-hmm. And when you say offshore, are you talking, obviously Pennsylvania doesn't have a coastline. Are you talking about rivers, bodies of water, or are you talking about something that actually is offshore that the power would be, there would be some transmission to Pennsylvania?
Yeah, we're talking windmills in the ocean.
Okay, right, and that's what I thought you were talking about. With promoting solar here, and I want to get into, you know, some of the nuts and bolts of it here in just a minute, but with those other renewables that are out there, I know if I ask you, will they be neglected to the benefit of solar, you're going to say, no, that's not going to happen. But how will you continue to expand wind, you know, some of the other renewables that are out there while also promoting solar?
Sure. So what I would say is, I think with each of these resources, renewables tend to get classified in one big swath. And I think, you know, one of the things Dave just said is really important. For example, wind, we have a really good resource, but it extends from that southwest corner up into the northeast along a very specific band. It's not an opportunity that's available for everyone. So we want to make sure we are promoting everything, but we are promoting it within its right space. You know, one of the things that's talked about in the Solar Future Report is revisiting that portfolio standard to increase solar. But I think as part of that conversation, you want to talk about wind and you want to talk about some of the other renewables out there.
I don't want to get off track with talking about the other renewables since we are focusing mostly on solar. There are two types of solar energy systems, smaller ones that we see on homes and buildings that house businesses, a lot of barns, a lot of farms I'm seeing in Pennsylvania that have solar panels. And then there are the larger scale grid systems that are connected directly to a transmission system. What are the benefits of both? What are the pros and cons? What are we looking at? Does this plan recommend one over the other?
It doesn't recommend one over the other. In fact, what we're seeing is a lot of the distributed systems are, you know, it's proceeding at a pretty good clip because of some of those financing mechanisms we talked about earlier. So it's really about, I think about it in two spaces. One, making sure how we maintain that momentum. But then two, how do we further incent and give opportunities for that grid scale? In terms of the differences between them, one is, there's a number of very technical things you can get into in terms of whether it's on a distribution grid or a transmission grid and those kinds of things. I think one of the big things, though, for Pennsylvanians is, and it's obvious when you say it, right, that when you're doing more of the distributed resource, it means more jobs. When you're installing it on a lot of rooftops and individual spaces, you're distributing it more. It requires more people to do that. If you're more invested in the grid scale side, you're building a lot of larger plants, and the job total goes down, but it's still significant. It ranges from 60,000 to 100,000, depending on the two paths we modeled, which was 65% grid versus 90% grid.
Right. Yeah, and I think that was an And that was part of why we scoped this out as a 10% goal. So it sort of challenged the status quo and allowed us to not just look at, well, we're going to continue this build out of distributed scale solar on rooftops, which are essentially consumer choice, you know, project by project. So how do we get to this 10% goal? How do we get to 11 gigawatts of solar by 2030? It's probably not going to happen just with the ground game of house by house, roof by roof, which allows us to then
slower.
Right, which just allows us to figure out, okay, we do not have much grid scale solar, large solar installations in PA. So what do we need to do? What strategies do we need to put in place in order to get us to that goal, challenge the status quo, and just not have it be this sort of slow march towards rooftop by rooftop distributed solar?
Several issues here. When you talk about job creation, is that a side benefit of that of this, or is it a priority?
I think it's a feature of it. It's not the priority of the plan necessarily, but it's definitely a part of it. You know, you need to evaluate, as you're making any policy decision, what are the broader implications of what we're doing? And the jobs benefit is certainly a part of that. And frankly, one of the ways I characterize this is when you look at what other states are doing and some of those other portfolio standards, you get into discussions where it's no longer just about, you want to take full advantage of that environmental benefit you're getting. You don't want to be in a place where 5-10 years from now, you're looking around and realizing not only have these other states surpassed us in terms of a portfolio standard, but the training is all happening in these other states. The facilities are manufacturing the plants, the panels rather, in other states. We want to take advantage of all of that within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and put forward the best plan environmentally and economically for the Commonwealth.
You know, there. Go ahead, David.
And I think also to go along with that, like what comes along with it is that there's this urban, suburban, and rural piece of this as well. And so when we talk about distributed, we talk about suburbia, we talk about rooftops on homes, when we talk about grid scale, we're talking about rural, rural development.
We're talking about these, takes up a lot of space.
You mentioned farms earlier, you know, so farms, so other low value land, whether it be landfills or abandoned mine lands or other places like that. So not only does jobs come along with this, it's where is this stuff going to be sited? Where are these solar panels going to go? And there's a lot of opportunities for rural Pennsylvania within, you know, a solar build out in PA.
You know, many times when I've had a discussion about solar power or actually any renewable in the past, you know, I hear people say that, well, the coal jobs are going to go away, that we are not going to have as many coal miners and coal mines as we, you know, go away from coal. But often the people having that conversation say these jobs in renewables will replace coal jobs. That's not a one-for-one kind of trade. I can't see, like, every coal miner saying, you know what, I'm going to get a job installing solar panels.
No, I think there's a geographic specificity to that, and you know, I think it's everything in its right box, right? The what's going on in the coal industry is largely driven by market forces. That the price of gas is far lower. The renewables have come down. The coal prices have been relatively constant and have lost out there. So we as a Commonwealth, that's a conversation we definitely need to have, is what is next for those coal miners who are losing their jobs as the next coal mine closes. We need to be engaged in that discussion. It won't all necessarily be renewable jobs. That's certainly a help. But yeah, it's not a panacea for this. For
By
sure.
the way, these installation jobs working in the solar industry, are these good paying jobs?
Yeah, in the study, I think what we found is it's $20 to $38 an hour, depending on the specific job. So they're good paying jobs.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to talk about here with the secretary and the director in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We were talking about a state report that was just put out called Finding Pennsylvania Solar Future, talking about the state getting 10% of its electricity by the year 2030 from solar power. Our guest today, Patrick McDonald, Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, David Althoff, who is the Director of DEP's Energy Program. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We are on, we're on Twitter at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Leonard in York. Leonard, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to find out what, if anything, the state is doing to encourage co-use of space like rooftops as opposed to taking land as a dedicated solar farm. For example, I think it would be a bad use of space to cut down a forest or use farmland to create a solar farm if the goal is to reduce carbon in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call. Mentioned just a few minutes ago that if we're going to do the grid, it does take up a lot of land.
Sure, and I think one of the things we identified, again, in the report is in order to achieve that 11 gigawatts, it's a relatively small amount of land. I don't have the precise acreage in terms of percentage of the state. But the couple things are, one, we also identified that there's a lot of opportunity around landfills, grazing lands, abandoned mine lands. We have twice as much abandoned mine land as we would actually need in order to accomplish 11 gigawatts in terms of that acreage. So I don't think this needs to be one where we're making a choice about forest land, for example. As we're dealing with the variety of environmental goals and climate goals, that's certainly not the direction we would want to go. And then I do think that there's, we saw a number of projects as part of the most recent Commonwealth Finance Agency, the 78 projects that they funded that were rooftop. And as we see warehouses and as we see these larger facilities, there's a lot of opportunity there for those kinds of installations.
Yeah, we actually had a listener who said, what about putting panels on all the warehouses, make it mandatory? Now, I don't know if you can do that or not, but it could be to the benefit of those warehouses if they would do something like that.
I don't think we have that regulatory authority. One of the challenges there can be, and it's something you need to think about ahead of time, is making sure when you're adding solar panels to a roof, and they did this even at my house, right? One of the first things they do is make sure the roof can handle that the extra weight of those panels. The warehouses aren't always designed with a solar array in mind on top of it.
Well, we had a question from, and David, I'll get to you in just a moment, but we did have a question from a listener who wanted to know. Now, you're not in installers, but I'm sure this is a question that many homeowners or those who own a building, a bar, or anything like that have, and that is, how can the roof be maintained once the solar panels are there?
Well, in reality, to some degree, the solar panels on top of the roof provide actually some protection for the roof, right? So there's a lot of degradation from the sun relative on your roof. That's actually why roofs wear out. They wear out due to precipitation and sort of the sun's rays on the roof. So there is some argument that says putting solar on top of your roof actually makes your roof last longer. Even though there are penetrations within your roof, they're done by a professional to make sure that they're secure, it actually could extend the time frame of the roof that you're putting on.
If, though, say there was a leak in the roof, can you get under those solar panels to make a repair?
Just like anything else. And you have penetrations in your roof. You have a chimney in your roof. You have pipes that for your plumbing that come out through your roof. So essentially, they flash those systems as well. And it's the same as any other roof repair.
Mm-hmm. I always find it fascinating that I can tell that there are people who are thinking, okay, this is something that I would entertain, I would like to do, but they're always looking for the, what are some of the downfalls of it? So it's a good thing, though, that people are asking questions like that, that are kind of logistical questions.
No, and I'll just offer, I know when we had ours done, that was a question we asked, frankly, what if, for whatever reason, we needed to replace the roof, even, not even just a repair, department. And, you know, for a small fee, they'd come out, take the panels off. We do the roof. They put the panels back on.
Just quickly back to the caller's question. I think the caller was right on it. You know, one of the strategies in the plan is land use and siting. And it's about, you know, making sure that we make choices, have uniform policies, encourage conservation relative to siting these solar installations. You know, the number is for the 90% grid scale strategy that we modeled, it's less than 0.3% of Pennsylvania's land area for siting grid scale solar. We already have that amount of land area in abandoned mine lands, nearly that amount of land area in landfills within the state already. So we just need to be smart. They need to be local decisions. We need to discuss these things. So therefore, it's clear what folks want relative to siting and deploying solar arrays within their community. We think there's plenty of areas, and we need to figure out where they're at.
But, Director, I have to tell you, though, that 0.3% of Pennsylvania's land area still is a lot of area.
It's a lot of area. It's like 124,000 square miles, right? So it's a lot of area. But we have a lot of area in Pennsylvania that has been used historically for a lot of energy projects. And so it's you know, it's not off the beaten path relative to land mass that is necessary for large-scale energy generation.
Let me get back to the first caller's question. Are there solar grids in state forest land right now, state forest land? And if so, would that be expanded?
I don't believe we have any grid-scale solar. I know DCNR has been using it, for example, at some of their environmental centers, education facilities. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Right. PennDOT has been using for years when it comes to signs and signage and that kind of thing.
Yeah, DCNR is looking to basically green their entire operations, right? And they basically are putting up solar arrays, and they want to start using electric vehicles, and, you know, and so ultimately they're getting towards, you know, net zero. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and solar gives them a lot of, you know, gives an organization like DCNR a lot of flexibility, whereas before they have to think about, where's the power line coming in? Now they can start thinking about, I can put the center where it makes the most sense and solar array on it, some storage, and you know you're in business.
Thomas says, my electricity supplier contract was recently up. I changed to a well-known supplier that offered 100% renewable. He says it was wind at a fixed rate for 24 months. For a few hundredths of a cent less than the other traditional suppliers, I never thought I'd see the day.
Wind has, in particular, come very much down in price. We have a good wind resource in this state, and in some other states, wind is actually their base load. We see wind challenging prices in even places like Texas, which you wouldn't think, right? But gas plants and wind are starting to become very, very competitive in even a place like Texas.
Let's go to Pam in Harrisburg. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, I got two quick questions. Number one, can we use the roadside, such as divided highways and the sound barriers for solar location? And also, why can't the old coal mines and landfills be used for geothermal heat? Thank you very much. I appreciate the great show.
Thank you. I appreciate that we have listeners that are coming up with ideas. I don't know. I've never thought about that, but panels on the side of, like, the sound barriers or on highways. What about that?
It's something I would want to talk with PennDOT about. I don't know if there's a safety concern or anything like that, but I know in talking with Secretary Richards, she's very, very forward-thinking on a number of environmental issues, and we talk pretty regularly, so it's something I would definitely raise with her. On the other, I think, the abandoned mine lands for geothermal, I think that's something we could look at and talk about. I'm not sure the specifics of that. I think for the landfills, that's something we'd want to think pretty carefully about, because you're talking about then penetrating a place where you have the waste undergoing that anaerobic decomposition. I'm not sure if it would have an impact there. If anything, in a lot of those landfills, you're trying to make sure you're managing it to keep heat down.
Well, you don't want methane to escape even more than what we already have. Let's go to David in Gettysburg. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
In this time of transition to the renewable energy, how can we prevent exploitation?
Exploitation of customers?
No, where, say, a large city decides to take advantage of black or underdeveloped malls in surrounding rural counties to develop solar farms, and then those rural counties not any benefit.
Unfortunately, David, you're cutting out there a little bit, but I think we do have the gist of his question. Wants to make sure that there's no clear cutting of forest in rural counties, and the power is being sold to customers in those counties or in a city nearby.
Yeah, I think once again this gets back to land use and siting, right? And that there are actual opportunities sort of in areas outside of cities or towns, you know, open space areas, and it creates certain value to the property. You're putting a resource on that property that's going to be producing revenue for 25 or 30 years, adds some, you know, value to the property that otherwise wouldn't exist. So, you know, it's a business deal, right? And so ultimately, as we saw recently with the City of Philadelphia and Community Energy, you know, they're looking to site a large solar array, 70 megawatt solar array in Adams County. Right, essentially, that's going to be producing power, one quarter of the power for the City of Philadelphia. That's a business deal, and that's an opportunity for a landowner or landowners. I believe they probably stitched a couple parcels of property together to make that project happen, and that's going to be revenue for folks in Adams County that is being purchased. A power is being purchased from the City of Philadelphia.
Not on the battlefield, I hope.
Not on the battlefield.
Not on the battlefield.
The other thing I'd point out too, which I think is a part of that question you talked about, the making sure we're delivering that value. There's a space that's almost, I almost think of it as in between the grid scale and the distributed in terms of community solar, which we really haven't seen in the Commonwealth. And that's some of what the report addresses. This is, instead of having a panel serving a property or this grid scale going into transmission, building, you know, something usually mid-sized that a number of property owners can essentially buy shares of to help offset their electricity bill. Because of our net metering rules, we don't see that happening in the Commonwealth. There's a two-mile limit that has to be within, and it has to only serve one account. So I think there's some space there to make sure, if, you know, I grew up in a row home in Philly, there's no way my roof would have supported anything that would have been meaningful for our electric bill. But it would have been nice to have, you know, it'd be nice to have an opportunity to buy into a solar array somewhere locally.
You mentioned this, Director Althoff, that you didn't say mention there were two scenarios, but you touched on the amount of energy coming from grids. Two that were being considered: grid scale solar supplying 65% of that 10% goal that the state wants to get to, and the other is supplying 90% to get 10%. This goes back to the question of, you know, whether you put them on rooftops or you have the large scale grid system. Why the two scenarios? And it sounds almost as if you are leaning toward the 90% of being grid just because of the speed and logistics of getting to the 10% goal.
Well, I don't mean to sound that I'm leaning towards any one particular scenario. Ultimately, we set this aspirational goal of 10%, and we wanted to see what the differences were relative to most of it being grid scale and then only some of it being grid scale. Everybody agrees that we're going to need a certain amount of grid scale to reach this goal.
Has to happen
because the ground game, rooftop by rooftop, even though we have plenty of rooftops, we could get the whole thing out of rooftops. It's just probably not going to happen within that time frame. We wanted to see what were the differences with regards to jobs, what were the differences with regards to policies related to land use. How would we need to react differently to support a greater amount of distributed, if indeed that's sort of what the choices are going to be made, or how would we need to react relative to pushing for more grid scale to achieve the goal within that time frame?
Bill asks, how important is it to generate power close to where it's needed due to lost power in long transmission? Do you lose power in transmission?
You definitely lose power in transmission. And it's one of the things, actually, I know, you know, PUC has looked at, FERC has looked at, in terms of where
FERC
do you...
FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Correct. Sorry, talking the acronyms. And if you site generation at kind of the right end of a of congestion, you can reduce costs, reduce the impact on the grid. So the geography of this definitely matters, and you're seeing more of that, you know, right up to and including work down in Philadelphia around the shipyard to go examining microgrids that we've been involved in. Mm-hmm.
We only have a few minutes left. I want to thank both of you for being on today. So what's the next steps? The report was released last month. What are the next steps here?
Sure. So what we identified in the report was really a series of strategies, and right now that stakeholder group is looking at putting some specificity to that in terms of a support document of how it would actually carry this out. And then really we want to look at, you know, I think we clearly want to have a conversation around the Advanced Energy Portfolio Standard, for example, recommendation in the report to increase that solar share from the 0.5% up to 4 to 8%. So we want to engage in conversation. This is really, you know, in some ways we've constructed the diving board. Now it's time to jump in the pool.
So real quick, incentives. I mean, even though the cost may have come down, there are going to have to be some incentives for some people to do this on their roof, maybe even those for who would like to locate a grid on their property. Yeah. What about incentives?
So, again, some of the other recommendations in the report are everything from low interest loans to tax benefits and looking at those kinds of opportunities. It is, as I said at the beginning, a technology where we see the costs have reduced dramatically, see them continue to reduce. We see businesses making decisions that, hey, if I can enter into an agreement for even a part of my power, I now know this part of my electric bill will have no volatility to it for the next 10 years. So there's a number of economic drivers already. We want to make sure we're steering in the direction of both highlighting those, but also building upon those so that we reach the right economic outcome.
Will there be taxpayer money used in this?
That is something that I think, you know, it would be part of the conversation. I'm trying to think. I don't think any of the specific recommendations have that. There's some things in there like tax exemptions, you know, some tax benefits, as I said. But I don't think any direct subsidy was part of it.
Real quick, final question here, and it's unrelated to solar, although somehow it is related, and that is, a few weeks ago there was a petition filed the state would adopt a cap and trade, and all this obviously is directed at climate change and cleaning up the environment, reducing emissions. Your stance on that, do you have a position on that?
Sure. So two things, right? One is the process question, which is, as you said, we got a petition at our Environmental Quality Board. So we're evaluating right now to make sure it's complete. We'll bring a recommendation to the Environmental Quality Board as to whether to accept the petition based on that completeness. I think the secondary thing, and it's whether it's solar or whether it's yesterday I spent time up in the north central part of the state with Senator Jean Yaw and Representative Garth Everett, looking at flooding, areas that had been flooded up there. And it all comes back to a climate discussion. So I think it's an area where we need to be focused and need to be doing more.
Mm. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, Patrick McDonnell, and David Althoff, who is the Director of DEP's Energy Program. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Happy holidays. Hey.
You too.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Marie Cusick will be filling in for me. I'll be off tomorrow, but we're going to keep the energy theme going. Marie will be speaking with several guests about nuclear power. You know that Three Mile Island is scheduled to close next year, and there has been a move afoot to keep Three Mile Island and Beaver Valley open as part of the state's energy portfolio. Marie will be discussing that on tomorrow's show. Doctors across the United States have become increasingly vocal in addressing gun violence as a public health crisis. In Colorado, a diverse group that includes doctors,
public health researchers, and gun shop owners has come together to bridge the divide. The Colorado Firearms Safety Coalition has found common ground on at least one issue, preventing firearm suicide. Also, Americans who have been diagnosed with dementia will have their car keys taken away very often, but often not their firearms. NPR special correspondent Melissa Block reported both of these stories recently, and she joins us today. Melissa Block, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
You're getting to be a regular on this show, you know.
You can't keep me away.
Well, our listeners have heard you for years, but we were here at WITF just a few weeks ago, and now I'm just so happy that we have an opportunity to talk about this. You mentioned to me at that time that you'd be talking about the Colorado story. So how did these stories come about?
You know, I've been interested in issues about guns, gun safety, gun violence for a long time, and given what we've heard this year about so many mass shootings, I mean, what I know is that the statistics show that those, even though they get, and rightly so, get so much attention in the media, those are such a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction when you look at gun deaths in this country. 60%, over 60% of gun deaths are actually suicides, and we don't talk about that so much. And in calling around, there are just a number of people who are really engaged on this issue in Colorado. So I went out there and reported these two stories.
And by the way, if our listeners would like to join in the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Let's talk about suicide and firearms first. As you reported, physicians are taking a more active role in any discussion of guns. It seems unusual, though, that doctors and gun shop owners would be teaming up for almost anything. How did this come about in Colorado?
Yeah, I mean, it came about through a conversation between a doctor who's an emergency room physician, but also a public health researcher and specifically focusing on guns, and a firearms trainer who's also a doctor. They had a conversation and they put this coalition together. It includes gun range owners and this firearms trainer and a number of doctors and public health officials trying to find some common ground in particular on this one issue. There's a lot that they know they won't be able to find common ground on. You know, they're not going to agree on universal background checks or banning assault-style weapons. But if they can work on suicide prevention and some common goals there, that seemed to be fertile ground. And there are programs like that around the country. There's something called the Gun Shop Project, where gun shops are engaged in trying to at least spread awareness of suicide prevention and safe storage of firearms if someone is in particular crisis mode. So that's what they're working toward.
In your reporting, I'm trying to picture these conversations. Give us an idea of just what a conversation would be like between a doctor and someone who maybe is going through crisis.
Yeah, well, a part of it has to do with getting physicians who may not be comfortable or know much about guns to be more, as they call it, culturally competent in having those conversations. In other words, making sure they know what they're talking about so that patients will trust them, just like with any other issue. If you feel like somebody doesn't know what they're talking about, you're going to dismiss what they have to say. So part of it has to do with training doctors, maybe taking them, as I saw when I was out there, taking them to a shooting range and have them just learn components of firearms and what it's like to shoot them. But also just to be aware that there are no regulations that bar doctors from talking to patients about guns. That's a common misperception, that there are no bars on that conversation, and to encourage them to include that in their list of things if they're concerned about safety of patients and in particular with risk of suicide, to have that conversation and to specifically engage them on the issue of, are there firearms in the home? You know, where are they? Is there someone you can give them to? And also, doctors need to be aware of the laws in their states about who you can legally transfer firearms to, because they do differ from state to state.
You mentioned two of the doctors that are very involved in this project and starting the project. Dr. Emmy Betts is one of them, the ER doctor. I want to hear from one of your stories, something she had to say.
What I say to people is, if you want to reduce suicide deaths, you have to talk about firearms. And if you want to reduce firearm deaths, you have to talk about suicide. They are so linked in this country. And when we talk with patients, it should not be about Second Amendment rights. It should not be about politics. That has no place in the exam room. This should really be about home safety.
You know, and I have to admit, Melissa, that something I thought about, and this isn't related to suicide, but it could be with any mental health issue. You know, there seems to be, in the last few years, a lot of focus after mass shootings about doing more with mental health and trying to diagnose mental illness. I think back to Sandy Hook, that shooter who was diagnosed with severe mental illness, but yet his mother kept guns in the house. That would appear to be a perfect opportunity for a doctor to say that he's been diagnosed with a mental illness. He should not have access to firearms in the home.
Well, and then there are, you know, it's interesting because doctors have told me that a parent might say, well, the guns are locked up and my kid doesn't know where the key is. And the kid will say, actually, I know exactly where that key is. So the notion that even if they're in the home but locked up or kept safe may be a flawed perception. And a lot of doctors will say, look, the safest thing you can do is to get the guns completely out of the home.
Mm. Dr. Michael Vikaroff is another. And you said that, you know, he actually is a gun owner and does a lot of
firearms instructor.
Firearms instructor. Let's hear from him.
Yeah.
And I never saw that coming. I didn't have the slightest clue. I didn't know she owned a gun. Now, this week, if I were talking to her, I would say, do you have a gun in the house? Do you have access to a gun? Does this figure into any of your plans? You know, and if so, I'd really like to talk to you about changing plans.
And I should have led up to that by saying he's talking about a patient that he had years ago who actually took her life by a firearm.
Right, and he's saying that now, you know, he would definitely have a very different conversation. It just was not on his radar at the time, but that he now, and he would want other doctors now to have those conversations with their patients.
Do you know whether there has been any reduction in the number of suicides with guns in Colorado as a result of this?
Yeah, it's so hard to quantify that. I know Emmy Betts, who we heard from earlier, is doing all sorts of studies and trying to figure out what is effective and what data can be brought to bear, but it doesn't really exist at this point besides anecdotally. I mean, I will point out, I was looking at Pennsylvania's numbers on guns before I came in here. Colorado is pretty stark. I mean, if you look at the gun deaths in Colorado, 80% of them are suicide. In Pennsylvania, in your state, 62% of gun deaths in 2016, the last year they had numbers for, were suicide. And that's about the national average. If you look at gun deaths, I think we may assume that most of them are crimes or homicides. That's not the case. The overwhelming majority are suicide.
Melissa, you know, you've said that everyone involved in this project will admit that you have to keep the politics out of it. But anytime you have a discussion about firearms in this country today, it is very difficult to do that. And as you said, that many doctors have to be educated when it comes to firearms. And I assume that they can't pass judgment on someone that owns a firearm or that may shut down the person who owns the firearm.
Well, the doctors may own firearms themselves.
That's true.
That's not necessary. You know.
It's a long way to go for this question, but the NRA says that doctors don't have a role in this and that they should stay in their own lane, as they put it. The doctors involved in this don't see it that way.
Right, and that became a viral meme on the internet of doctors showing images of gunshot violence in their emergency rooms and patients they were treating and saying, look, this is my lane. I spoke with a medical student when I was in Colorado who's part of this coalition, and he said, you know, that is just so offensive. This absolutely is my lane. And if we start talking about lanes, there's no way we're going to solve this problem, that we have to be sharing this space and talking about it and trying to figure out ways to improve things. One of the gun range owners that I spoke with in Colorado had a really tragic event. They had a customer or a client commit suicide on their gun range a year before I had visited them. And now they have changed their protocol to the extent that they can. The one thing that they do now is that if someone comes in by him or herself to rent a gun to shoot on the range and they don't know that person, they will then have to provide someone who they can call to verify for their mental state. Now, is that foolproof? No. Our gun shop salespeople psychiatrists? Absolutely not. And they know there's only so much they can do. But part of it is raising awareness and spreading information and giving folks in crisis resources that they can use.
Yeah, we focused during our conversation pretty much on the physicians. But the gun shop owners, I mean, mm-hmm. they have a lot of stake here as well. I mean, hopefully, and I think I can say this with all accuracy, that most gun shop owners do not want to see guns or product that they have sold be used in a crime, be used in
Absolutely.
A suicide. But as you also said, they're not psychiatrists. So what can they do?
Well, that is one thing. The policy that I mentioned, which I believe a number of gun shop owners are trying to do, is to weed out anyone who might be coming to the range by him or herself who they've never seen before, they don't know. One step that they do. The gun shop project nationwide began with a gun shop owner in New Hampshire who found out that guns he sold from his gun shop were used in 3 suicides. And that was the genesis for him. So part of it also is literature that they do have at the gun shops that talk about resources, talk about safe storage or for people in crisis getting guns out of the home. But it is a really intractable problem, partly because guns are designed to be lethal, and folks who commit suicide or attempt suicide with firearms take that suicide to completion about 90% of the time. It's a number far higher than any other means of suicide.
Melissa, I want to move on to the second story that you reported, and mm-hmm. that has to do with guns and dementia. As your story says, there are many caregivers or children will tell a parent when it's time to stop driving if that parent or the person has been diagnosed with dementia, but they don't talk as often about retiring their guns once they have been diagnosed. Why not?
Well, you know, it's not on the radar as much, and it's interesting. When I started looking into this, I was curious about it because it wasn't something that I had heard much about. And what I've heard from listeners since this story aired was, you know, that they hadn't thought about it, and it did give them one more thing either to worry about or to work on with their aging, either parents or grandparents. But it is a real concern, and they're folks in the dementia community or in the gun community are also trying to raise awareness about this as a real risk. And there are tragic cases of folks with dementia who have maybe mistaken someone in their own family for an intruder or someone they don't know. We know what happens with dementia, right? That you lose perception of who people are. You often don't recognize family members. I heard from a listener in Texas after the story ran who related just a horrific incident of her grandfather, a retired FBI agent, who slipped further and further into dementia. And she discovered when she went to their home that her grandfather, had shot and killed his wife of many, many decades with his FBI-issued gun and then turned the gun on himself. And the family is, you know, racked with not only grief but regret that gun was still in the home and it wasn't something they had considered. And in fact, she said that if her mother had heard the story, you know, before this all happened, that she was sure that she would have gotten guns out of the home, which is both horrible to read and hopefully, you know, might prevent another incident in another family. That's what you would always want to see.
In that last question, I used the word retire a gun on
mm-hmm.
purpose.
Yeah.
During the story, you got pieces of advice of how to have that conversation with someone. I mean, again, if I use the it's time to give up the keys, there may be some mm-hmm. Someone being defensive. Same way with if you say it's time to give up the guns. But there's a different way to do that, right?
Yeah, and this was what one of the psychologists I spoke with at the VA in Denver told me. I mean, if you say, look, I'm going to take your guns, that's not going to go over very well, right? People have, gun owners, a lot of them have a really strong connection to or feel that guns are a really key part of their identity. So she very carefully uses the word retiring. Let's retire you from driving and let's retire your guns, and that can be a more palatable way to have that conversation. They also suggest really having these conversations early, not to wait for families. And in fact, Emmy Betts, the doctor who you mentioned earlier, has suggested a sort of firearms agreement, an advance directive on firearms. Wouldn't be legally binding, but it's something to sort of have on paper and have a discussion with a family member. what would you want to happen? What do you want to see happen with your firearms at a certain point in your life or as you as your dementia progresses?
NPR special correspondent Melissa Block, always nice to talk to you, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We will be putting, you can find Melissa's stories if you haven't heard them live on the air. You can find them on NPR's website. We'll have a link on our website, WITF.org. Melissa, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks again.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Tomorrow, coming up on the show, we'll be talking about nuclear power and its future here in Pennsylvania.